From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, creating superheroes, we talk with Stan Lee, the man behind Spider-Man, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, and lots of other Marvel Comics superheroes. Also today, Michael Tolkien on writing and directing The Rapture, a new film about being born again and waiting for the apocalypse. One critic described it as a cross between Ingmar Bergman and Roger Corman. And TV critic David Bianculli says the networks are at it again, bringing some old shows back to life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in Killeen, Texas, revealed more information today about George Hennard, the man who drove a pickup truck through a restaurant window yesterday, then shot and killed 22 people and wounded 25 more. But the reason for the massacre remains a mystery. Glenn Mitchell reports.
Various details are gradually being uncovered about George Hennard, his conflicts with neighbors, the possibility that he may have had a grudge against women, the fact that he bought the two 9mm pistols used in the assault in Nevada. Clues to Hennard's motive, however, remain as shrouded as before. At a press conference this afternoon, Killeen Police Chief F.L. Giacomozzi said neither memos found in Hennard's house nor material gained in interviews have given any indication that he planned the attack. One matter has been resolved. Autopsy results confirmed that Hennard died of a self-inflicted wound that ended his shootout with five police officers. For National Public Radio, this is Glenn Mitchell in Killeen.
The House today rejected arguments that gun control provisions in the omnibus crime bill might have helped reduce the death toll in the Killeen shootings. House members voted 247 to 177 to remove provisions that would have banned certain semi-automatic assault weapons and large-capacity ammunition clips. The amendment to remove the gun control provisions was introduced by Missouri Democrat Harold Volkmer, who argued that the ban was a first step that could lead to restrictions on hunting weapons. The ban would not have applied to the semi-automatic pistol used by the gunman in the Killeen massacre, but it would have banned the sale of the 17-round clip that he used to reload his gun. The U.S. Navy has apologized to the family of a sailor who'd been blamed in the USS Iowa disaster. Gunner's mate Clayton Hartwig was killed along with 46 other sailors when the gun turret of the Iowa exploded during training in 1989. Today, the Navy told the family the evidence was too inconclusive to blame Hartwig. Kevin Niedermeyer of member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio, reports.
After more than 2 years of fighting the Navy's contention that sailor Clayton Hartwig purposely blew up the USS Iowa gun turret because of a failed relationship with another sailor, today the Hartwig family got the apology they've been seeking. Hartwig's mother, Evelyn, says she feels the Navy's apology is sincere, but the experience has forever changed their lives.
It's been a living hell for 2.5 years. I just hope no other parent has to go through this, but the Navy did reassure us that their investigations will be a lot different.
The Hartwigs will go forward with a $40 million lawsuit against the Navy for emotional damage the situation has inflicted on them. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 8 points to close at 3,053. Declines edged advances in heavy trading of 203 million shares. This is NPR News. The Soviet Union's second most powerful republic said today that it will not sign the proposed economic union agreement with 9 other republics. Leaders from the Ukraine said that they want to maintain economic relations with the other republics, but that they refuse to be part of any economic or political union with the Central Soviet government. With 53 million people, the Ukraine is an important industrial and agricultural power in the Soviet Union, and it was considered a key participant in the economic union plan. The agreement is scheduled to be signed tomorrow at a ceremony in Moscow. United Nations officials say talks to free the remaining Western hostages in Beirut are moving forward. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
A UN spokesman confirmed that UN envoy John Domenico Pico is now in Damascus for talks on the hostages. Pico is Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar's personal representative in the talks, but the spokesman would not say whom Pico is meeting with. There have been published reports that Pico was holding direct talks with representatives of the groups holding the 9 remaining hostages and that the groups want the UN to protect them once the hostages are freed. Perez de Cuellar issued an appeal to all governments in the region to cooperate with his efforts to free the hostages. The UN has been trying to engineer a 3-way swap in which the captors will release the Westerners and provide information about the fate of 6 missing Israeli servicemen in exchange for the release of Arab prisoners now held in Israeli-controlled jails. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The World Jewish Congress issued a report today saying that anti-Semitism is on the rise in Central and Eastern Europe following the collapse of communism. Congress Director Ilan Steinberg said that the report looked at Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Yugoslavia. He said that while the study didn't find evidence of physical attacks on Jews, there was a rise in incidents such as cemetery desecration, vandalism, and anti-Semitic graffiti. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you talk about comic book superheroes, you have to talk about my guest, Stan Lee. He co-created Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men, the Silver Surfer, Daredevil, the Man Without Fear, the Invincible Iron Man, Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts, and Power Man. Stan Lee joined Marvel Comics 51 years ago. He's been Marvel's head writer, art director, and publisher. Now he oversees the adaptation of Marvel characters into films and television. The art publisher Abrams has just brought out an illustrated history of Marvel Comics. Stan Lee wrote the introduction. He told me how he came up with one of his most famous superheroes, Spider-Man.
Before I came up with the name Spider-Man, I had decided I wanted a superhero who could crawl on walls, stick to the ceiling, and so forth. And I said, gee, that's a real insect power. What'll I call him? And my first thought was Insect Man, and that just didn't do it for me at all. And then I thought, well, let's see, there's Mosquito Man. That really had no appeal at all. And I went down a whole list, and when I got to Spider-Man, I mean, it was like a bell rang, a light went off above my head. Spider-Man was it. And when I put the amazing in front of it, I knew we were home free.
What makes a superhero a Stan Lee superhero? What are some of the qualities?
Well, it has to be magnificently written. The creation has to be a work of genius. But to be serious, the one thing that I've tried to do is give them the most human and realistic qualities possible. Now, it may sound like a contradiction in terms because our superheroes are fantasy characters with superpowers that no human being possesses, and yet I try to be realistic about it. But the basic idea is you take one fantastic element, like, well, with a Hulk, like somebody who's got the strength of 50 men and green skin, and then you say, suppose such a character really existed. What would his life be like in the real world? Where would he live? What would he wear? Who would he relate to? And so forth. And having asked the reader to suspend disbelief in the area of the character's superpower, you then try to make everything else as realistic as you can. Oh, and then the other thing that we try for very much is humor. Now, I guess before Marvel Comics started, there wasn't too much humor in superhero adventures. But for instance, with Spider-Man, I tried again to inject the humor in such a way that it was realistic. For example, there was a time when he had received a check as a reward for something he had done. And he was so happy to have this money, this check made out to Spider-Man. And he went to a bank to cash it in his Spider-Man costume. And the teller behind the counter said, well, I can't cash this check. I need identification. And he said, I'm wearing a Spider-Man costume. He said, anybody could wear a Spider-Man costume. Who are you? And he said, I've got a secret identity. I can't tell people who I am. And anyway, this went from bad to worse. And he was never able to cash the check. Now, to me, the interesting thing about that was I really wasn't trying to be funny so much as I was trying to be realistic. Because what would happen if a guy in a Spider-Man suit had a check that he tried to cash?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Lee, who has been with Marvel Comics for decades, and he's been the editor-in-chief, the head writer. He now oversees all the TV and movie adaptations of the Marvel characters. And he's written the introduction to a new collection of Marvel Comics and a history of Marvel called Marvel. How did the superheroes that you created compare to the kinds of heroes in comics when you started working at Marvel back when you were a teenager?
Well, when I started working for the comics, all the heroes were really cut out of the same mold. They were tall and handsome and strong and noble, and as far as their dialogue went, I felt insufferably dull.
Give me an example of the type of writing you thought was really
all
square
right.
and dull.
Okay. I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that you're walking down the street and you see a monster coming toward you. And this monster is 12 feet tall with purple skin, four arms, a tail, and he's breathing fire and he's got two heads. And if in those days, if Superman or Batman or one of our own characters, Captain America or anybody, any typical superhero, had seen this monster walking down the street in one of the stories, I think the dialogue would have gone something like this. Oh, a creature from another world. I'd better capture him before he destroys the city. Well, I would like to feel that in one of our comic books, one of our heroes, such as Spider-Man, might say, who's the nut in the Halloween costume? I wonder what he's advertising. And it was just that shade of difference. I tried to do dialogue that represented the way real flesh and blood, three-dimensional people would talk and would react to things. And it came across as satire. But I wasn't trying to write humor. I was trying to be realistic. So I must be funnier than I thought.
Now, what about deciding on the alliterative sounds that you would use when somebody got hit?
Oh, I loved sounds. And again, I think what it is, I've always hated cliches. As you can imagine, formally in the comics, if somebody was hit or if there was a sound effect of a loud noise, the sound effect would be pow or bam or sock or bop. Something of that sort. So I tried to make up crazy sound effects that would at least be original. I would have PFZZAKT, which I cannot pronounce, but that might be the sound of a bullet going through a wall or something. One of my all-time favorite sound effects was BTKOOM, and it was spelled BTKOOOM with three O's. And then I put a little asterisk at the end of the word with a note on the bottom of the panel saying the third O, of course, is silent. And so I had fun with the sound effects. As far as the alliterative names, most of our characters had alliterative names. There was Peter Parker and Bruce Banner and Reed Richards. And I had a very pragmatic reason for doing that. I have a terrible memory, always did. And it was difficult for me to remember the names of my characters. But by having the same first letter for a character, if I could remember the Peter, it gave me a clue that the last name also began with P, and I would eventually remember it was Parker, you see. So it made it easier for me to remember the names by giving them the same first letter.
We've been talking about superheroes that you've done, but wasn't there a period when you were also writing Millie the Model and maybe romance comics?
I've written everything, really. Mm-hmm. Before Marvel became big and we were publishing all sorts of comics, we followed the trends. And there would suddenly be a trend for romance comics, let's say. All of a sudden, the romance comics started selling. Well, the minute that happened, we ended up publishing more romance comics than anybody. And I'm afraid we weren't too original in our choice of titles. We had names like My Love, Our Love, Your Love, Their Love, My Romance, Your Romance, Their Romance, and on and on. And then when Westerns would suddenly become popular, we would suspend the love titles and we'd go into Westerns. And my publisher then, he had a thing for the word kid. So we would have the Texas Kid, the Montana Kid, the Dakota Kid, the Nebraska Kid, and Kid Cold Outlaw, which was one of my favorites. I wrote most of all of these. And then we'd have humor magazines, and it's slated a little bit more for females. And we had Millie the Model, Tessie the Typist, Nellie the Nurse. And there again, I try to be alliterative, so to speak, with the titles. And then we'd go to animated type comics. We had Silly Seal and Ziggy Pig and Terry Toons, based on the Terry Toon movie characters, and more names than I can remember, Super Rabbit and Floop and Skilly Boo and ridiculous names. Then there were war magazines that were popular at one time, and I was writing Battlefield and Battlefront and Battle Adventures and Battle and War and War Combat and Combat Kelly and Combat Casey and on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Lee, and he created many of the superheroes for Marvel Comics. He's been the editor-in-chief and the head writer and so on, and he's still with Marvel, and there's a new collection of Marvel Comics that's just been published by the art publisher Abrams. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stan Lee is my guest of Marvel Comics. What was the comic book code like when you started working?
Well, it wasn't there when I started working, but when we began to have some pressures from certain groups, we instituted a code that was similar to the motion picture code at that time. And it was what you'd expect. There couldn't be too much untoward sex. The female characters had to be pretty covered up. Just what you'd expect. There mustn't be any blood shown, and if there were any violent battle scenes, nobody could have a head chopped off, or, you know, the usual things.
Well, things that I wouldn't expect is that the comic book code outlawed the use of werewolves and vampires. I find that hard to understand.
Well, that didn't last very long. I mean, we argued those points, and we finally got them to change that.
So how did it work? Every time you finished a comic, you had to send it to the office?
Yeah, we would send it to them, and except for these one or two instances, there was really no problem. They did a good job, and everything was fine.
You didn't resent their existence?
Not really, no. No. In fact, I thought they served a good purpose because it stopped people from criticizing the comics. And if they did criticize, I would just tell them, call the code.
What kinds of criticism did you get before the code?
Not too many, as a matter of fact. We were too busy just doing our work. We didn't even, until we started Marvel Comics, which was years later, we never got any phone calls. We never got any fan mail. I wish we had. We didn't even get letters of protestation. Occasionally, we'd get a letter from a reader saying something like, I just bought one of your books, and there's a staple missing in the binding, and I want my dime back. And we would be so excited. It was proof somebody had bought a book. We'd hang the letter up on the bulletin board, you know, and be proud of it for a while. It was only after we started Marvel Comics and came out with our new group of superheroes with the so-called new Marvel style that the mail began to really pour in, and it became an avalanche. And that's when everything changed for us.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but why do superheroes so often wear tights?
I don't know. I think it is simply precedent. It started out that way. The first books, and I wasn't around at that time, had them that way. The funny thing is, when I did our first superhero book, The Fantastic Four, in an effort to avoid the cliché, I told the artist, I don't want costumes on these guys. I just want them to wear clothes. So they didn't have skin-tight costumes. We sent the book out. It was published. We received a lot of fan mail. The kids said they loved it. We knew we had a winner, and we were on our way now. But virtually every letter said, we think it's the greatest book. We'll buy it forever. We love it. Turn out more. But if you don't give them colorful costumes, we won't buy the next issue. And I do not know. I think you'd have to be a psychologist or a sociologist or something and do an intensive study. But there, for some reason, unless these characters are garbed in some sort of outlandish outfit, the readers don't seem to accept that. Even the Hulk. I had no great reason for giving him green skin, except I knew if he had normal colored skin, we probably wouldn't sell as many books. There has to be something colorful about the way they look, visually.
Are you a colorful dresser yourself?
No, I'm the most conservative guy you'll ever see. I wear jeans a lot, but I don't know that that's very colorful.
What about physically? Do you have any special physical strengths?
Oh, I'm incredibly powerful. Right. I've got these broad shoulders and bulging, but no, I'm kind of tall and skinny, and nobody would ever mistake me for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I want to get back to what you were saying before, that you couldn't create a character without a colorful costume because the readers swore they'd never read it, no matter how much they love the character.
That's right. I could create it, but it's just I don't think we would have sold it.
Yeah, right, right. Well, now, with women superheroes, I bet the equivalent is, no matter how wonderful the character, you have to give her a large bosom or else they won't buy it.
Well, I guess you're right, but I don't know that it's anything sexist as much as symbolic. For example, you'll find that most of the heroes, as I say, they have broad shoulders and big biceps, and, you know, they're all sort of Schwarzeneggers, and most of the women are Marilyn Monroes, and I think it's just that the artists try to draw idealized men and women. And I guess that's the way most people idealize people.
What you've been doing for years now at Marvel is overseeing the adaptation of Marvel characters into television and film stories. Mm-hmm. So do you initiate these things, or do people come to you and make you offers?
It works both ways. And I've been out on the coast long enough now that I know most of the so-called power players in the movie and television business. And it's taken a while to get started. But right now, I think you're going to be seeing a lot of Marvel product on the screen, or a lot of our characters. Now, for example, Jim Cameron, who did The Terminator, mm-hmm. Terminator 2, is about to do write, direct, and produce a very big movie of Spider-Man, and I'm incredibly excited about that. I think he's the best possible person to do this movie, and I think it's going to be an absolute blockbuster.
So how do you like being Spider-Man's agent instead of Spider-Man's creator?
Oh, I enjoy doing what I'm doing. I moved out to Los Angeles about 10 years ago to set up a Marvel animation studio. I worked there for a few years to get that going. And then little by little, I got into motion pictures and television. And it's very exciting to be in a new field at a time when a lot of guys are starting to think about retiring. And I've got this whole world opening up in front of me, and I'm still able to keep in touch and keep my finger in on the comic book. So I figure I'm about the luckiest guy around. I really love what I'm doing, and each day seems to be more exciting than the day before.
So, Stan Lee, maybe one last thing you can clear up for me before we have to say goodbye. Your birth name is Stanley Lieberman.
No, dear.
Stanley Lieber?
Yeah, I was
Stanley Lieber.
I was born Stanley Martin Lieber. Which is a very, I think, lovely, normal name. And as I said, I wanted to write the great American novel. And when I got working in a comic book company, I said, I'm not going to use my name for these silly comics. So I was 17. And when you're 17, you don't know that much. I thought, I need a pen name. And I made up the name Stan Lee, and I started using it. And what happened was, everybody, as the years went by, started to know me as Stan Lee, and nobody knew me anymore as Stanley Lieber. So I would go to buy something and tell them to charge it, and they wanted to see my identification. I said, charge it to Stan Lee. But I had to show them my driver's license, which said Stanley Lieber. And it got so complicated that I finally legally changed my name to Stan Lee, which was a dumb thing to do because Stan Lee is such a stupid name. And people always say to me, Stan Lee what? So I'm thinking of changing my name now to Stanley what? So when they say that, I can say, that's right.
So is Stan Lee short for Stanley or short for
Lieber.
Stan Lieber?
I don't know, really. I can't remember whether I cut Stanley into two names or whether I figured Stan from Stanley and Lee from Lieber. I don't remember what the thinking was, but I figured Stan Lee sounds right for comic books.
Well, it certainly worked, hasn't it?
It hasn't hurt, really.
Stan Lee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Comic book writer, editor, and publisher Stan Lee. A new illustrated history of Marvel Comics has just been published by Abrams. Entertainer Tennessee Ernie Ford died this morning at the age of 72. He was suffering from a liver ailment. Ford was a country and gospel singer and hosted a popular primetime TV show during the 1950s. In 1955, his version of the Merle Travis song, 16 Tons, was a number one hit for 7 weeks. Last year, Tennessee Ernie Ford visited Fresh Air.
Every recording artist likes to have a song that identifies him with the rest of his life. Bing Crosby and I were playing golf together one time, and he said, you know, a great identity. He said, even though I'm working somewhere in the middle of July, I can't leave the stage until I sing White Christmas. And, of course, that identity that stays with you the rest of your life is a dream of all recording artists, and 16 Tons did that for me.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal, and the straw boss said, well, to bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One day, Michael Tolkien saw a bumper sticker that read, "Warning, in case of rapture, this car will be unmanned." That led Tolkien to wonder what it would be like if the end of the world happened exactly like it's described in the Bible. That thought led to Tolkien's new movie, The Rapture. Coming up, a talk with Tolkien about why he made a film about what he lacks himself, faith. And TV critic David Bianculli looks ahead to two shows he says you should be sure to miss. And he looks back at the one show no one could turn off. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the wake of yesterday's mass shooting in Texas on Capitol Hill, members of the House debated a ban on certain semi-automatic weapons and large ammunition clips. But despite the emotion generated by the shooting, House members turned down the ban by a vote of 247 to 177. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
Texas lawmakers were vocal today in the debate, which was scheduled well in advance of the shooting. Although many of the 27 Texas representatives spoke about the tragedy in their home state, just six voted against the ban. Democrat Chet Edwards, a gun control opponent, urged his colleagues today to support the measure.
"We cannot bring back the lives lost in my district yesterday, but I hope with your vote today, perhaps, just perhaps, you can save a life in your neighborhood tomorrow."
The debate did not center on the limit of gun clips that allowed the shooter in Texas to fire multiple rounds without reloading. Rather, it focused on whether the ban was a first step toward outlawing hunting weapons. Gun control advocate Sarah Brady was bitter about today's defeat. She said it's just one more reason to be utterly disgusted with Congress. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Bush says that the U.S. Senate should have held hearings behind closed doors into allegations of sexual harassment against U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Clarence Thomas. Mr. Bush also defended his administration's record concerning sexual harassment. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
The president said something good might come out of the contentious Thomas hearings. Speaking to a group of newspaper editors in a televised hookup, Mr. Bush said the charges made by Anita Hill might lead to a sensitivity to the problem of sexual harassment. Yet the president said the public might have been spared some of the details of the charges.
"I was troubled. I was thinking of my little grandchildren hearing some of the graphic sex allegations. And yet, setting that aside for a minute, I do think there was something sensitizing about the question of sexual harassment."
Mr. Bush said he felt that feminist groups leading the opposition to Thomas did not represent the views of most women, nor, he said, did civil rights leaders speak for most African Americans. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
NATO officials have announced the largest nuclear arms cut since the alliance started deploying these arms in the early 1950s. NATO defense ministers have agreed to do away with 80% of their arsenal of nuclear-armed shells, short-range missiles, and gravity bombs based in Europe. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 8 points to close at 3,053 on volume of some 203 million shares. Trading today was extremely heavy. This is NPR News. PLO chief Yasser Arafat is said to be planning to go to Syria within 48 hours. The purpose of the trip is to talk about plans for a Middle Eastern peace conference. It's believed to be the first trip to Damascus by Arafat since the early 1980s. A PLO official also says that Syrian President Assad has told Secretary of State James Baker that he will not attend a Middle Eastern peace conference unless Palestinians are also included. On the eve of the formal signing of a treaty creating an economic community among the Soviet Union's remaining republics, the Ukraine, the Soviet Union's most important republic after Russia, has decided to pull out of this agreement. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
It was never certain just how many of the Soviet Union's remaining 12 republics would commit themselves to some form of economic union. But President Gorbachev and his team have been saying publicly that all except Georgia and Moldavia would come around by tomorrow, the date for the formal signing of the agreement. Now the Ukraine, by any measure one of the most important industrial and agricultural regions in the Soviet Union, has said no. According to Ukrainian politicians who explained their decision on television in Kiev, Ukraine intends to be independent, not tied formally to a central government in Moscow. They also object to a provision in the economic treaty that would divide the Soviet Union's $70 billion international debt among the republics. The Ukraine is so important to the Soviet Union that it is not clear at this point whether the economic treaty will be signed tomorrow and what it will mean if it is. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Officials of the World Bank have promised to help the Soviet Union amid calls from Moscow to divert military funds to efforts to speed up economic development. A meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund focused on ways to help the Soviet Union move to a market economy. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Michael Tolkien is the author of the 1988 novel The Player that's now being made into a film. Tolkien wrote the screenplay, Robert Altman is directing, Tim Robbins is the star. But we have another Tolkien film to talk about that just opened, an independent film written and directed by Tolkien. It's called The Rapture, and it's about religious faith, those who have it and those who don't. Film critic Roger Ebert said it takes what Christian religions teach about God and Jesus and carries those teachings to their uncompromising implications. It is the only movie I can remember since Ingmar Bergman's Silence of God trilogy that deals entirely with spiritual questions while not proceeding from a devout or religious point of view. But another film critic, Jay Hoberman, describes The Rapture as a loopy blend of Bergman and Roger Corman, set in as lurid a low-rent universe as you're likely to find outside the pages of the National Enquirer. Mimi Rogers stars as a telephone operator who spends her off hours with her sex partner in exotic orgies with other couples. When she realizes her life is empty, she accepts Jesus and is born again. In this scene, her partner realizes she's changed and assumes she's found another man.
Is he as bad a boy as I am?
I think you should meet him.
You told him about me?
I told you. He knows everything.
He's rich, right? He's some rich guy, and you fell for some line of his.
You could love him, too.
You fell for some rich homosexual.
He's the Lord Jesus Christ, Vic. He's the Son of God.
Were you going through some kind of spiritual crisis yourself when you wrote The Rapture?
Well, I suppose I'm always going through some kind of spiritual crisis. And when I wrote The Rapture, what really provoked it was a bumper sticker that I saw on the freeway that said, "Warning, in case of rapture, this car will be unmanned." And at the time, I was in a bad mood about my life, and also a bad mood about Hollywood and what I was doing in Hollywood. And in some way, that bumper sticker presented to me a kind of salvation to both problems, which was to be able to write a story that was about faith and also write a movie that would, or write a screenplay. I wasn't sure if I was going to get it made as a movie, but at least write a screenplay that sort of satisfied a lot of theoretical problems I was having with what was happening in movies at the time.
What kind of problems are you talking about?
Well, living in New York in 1978, my favorite movie of the year was Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but I had also was also going to the New Yorker Theater and seeing all the Fassbinder and all the German movies, and I didn't see any problem in reconciling the two. I liked them both, and I suppose I've always sort of liked schlock and art simultaneously. And And when I moved out here in the 80s, trying to be a screenwriter and not getting anything produced, both my frustration with not being I was frustrated with not being produced, and I was also somehow getting clearer about the movies and why I was having, I guess being in Hollywood, I was closer to the church that was producing the myths, and I became really disenchanted with entertainment. And by the time E.T. came around, I was in a really sour mood every time I went to the movies, and I just felt like I was the one guy at the Nuremberg rally who wasn't happy. And and so I wanted to make a film that sort of took back from Hollywood the idea that a spectacle had to be positive.
Often when someone does a story or a film on born-again Christianity, if they're not born-again themselves, it's a subject that's done with some satire or in a mocking way. Although you are not born again, and although the film finally is skeptical about born-againism, you take the subject very seriously. You don't set him up just to knock him down.
No, well, I it's too easy to mock, and mockery is really one of the essential problems with the age, I think, from both sides of the, both sides of the spectrum. The left is as guilty of mockery as the right is. And I there are say, two or three strains of thought that went into the rapture, and one of them was that in the early 80s I was watching a lot of evangelical television in Los Angeles on cable, and I felt very sympathetic to the concerns of the audience. I thought that 50, there are 50 million people in the United States who call themselves born again, and they all subscribe to the doctrine of the rapture, which is that before the day of judgment there'll be an ingathering and Christ will gather them into heaven. They'll be transformed immediately into spirit, and they'll be brought into heaven before the apocalypse. And I thought that wish for instant relief and instant salvation from the hard problems of living on the planet was something that all of us shared. And then the note that the film ends on is really the question I ask myself, which is why don't I believe in the New Testament? Why can't I accept Christ as my Savior? And what does it cost me?
So you are a Christian?
No, I'm not.
I mean, you're...
No, I'm not.
You're Jewish?
Yes.
So why would you accept Christ as your Savior? I mean, it seems like an odd question to be asking yourself if you're Jewish.
Well, because if someone is offering you the possibility of this kind of eternal salvation, what holds you back from that? Emotionally, intellectually, we can have all sorts of answers, but emotionally, something else is holding us back. Now, it might be also intellectual, and there might be tribal reasons, there might be philosophical reasons, but finally, what I thought I was coming to in the film is that it's impossible for me, and it's just as it's impossible for Sharon, Mimi Rogers' character in the film, to give up herself, and that she's given up herself during the course of the film, and at the end, what she comes to question is, in a sense, she says, I know there is a God, but I'm splitting faith into belief and love, and I'll keep my belief, but I will not give God my love. I will not love a God who has created a universe in which we are put to this constant test. And that's really the conclusion I came to. So in a sense, maybe the movie really resolved my crisis of faith.
I don't know if you'll agree with this perception or like it at all, but I think in the first part of your movie that the movie almost proceeds like a horror film, one of those horror films where some of the people have seen the invader from another planet,
right.
and they know that it's there, they know that it's true, but nobody else believes them.
Right.
So the movie is split between the believers and the non-believers, and we know that the believers are right because we've seen that invader from the other planet too.
Mm-hmm.
Except in this movie, it's those who have had the vision of God and those who haven't.
Right.
Did you intend to follow a horror movie style in setting up your questions about faith?
A little bit, sure. But we wanted to make the monster more complicated than the Day of the Triffids. We wanted to make a monster movie in which we knew that God was going to be perceived as the monster in the beginning of the movie. and would hang over the movie as in the same way that that the threat of the monster hangs over 1950s horror films. And also, in some way, this film was very consciously an attempt to make a version of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Behind all horror movies was always something much more frightening than real monsters, which is fate or death or eternity, and the fear of the unknown, and the ultimate unknown is God. And so, rather than make a movie in which the monster, in which there's a stand-in for the unknown, we decided to get rid of the stand-in and just deal directly with the unknown, and God is the unknown. Death is the unknown. Some people look at the rapture and say it's about God. Some people look at it and say it's really about death or about eternity. And I think both of those are true.
My guest is Michael Tolkien, writer and director of the new film, The Rapture. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. When last we spoke on Fresh Air, Michael Tolkien, you had just finished your novel, The Player. Right. Or I should say The Player had just been published.
Right.
This is a novel about a studio executive who gets threatening letters from an aspiring screenwriter. And let me just read the first letter here. Dear Griffin, I am still waiting for you to call. You said you'd get back to me. My answering machine is on all the time, so you can't say that you called, but I wasn't in. I told you my idea. You said you wanted to think about it, and you said you'd get back to me. My agent said that was a good sign, the part about getting back to me. I've waited long enough. You lied to me. It's obvious you have no intention of hiring me. In the name of all the writers in Hollywood who get pushed around by executives who know nothing more about movies than what did well last week and have no passion for film, I'm going to kill you. Well, this novel about the frustrated screenwriter who's threatening to kill the studio exec has been made into a film. You wrote the screenplay, and you're into what, the second cut or something?
We're deeply into post-production now. I saw the second cut a couple of days ago.
Now, I thought after writing this novel that no Hollywood executive would want to get near you, figuring that you had the same temperament as this crazy letter writer did. So I find it interesting that this novel actually help make your career in Hollywood.
I don't know, Terry. I've been trying to get... I wrote the novel to get out of Hollywood, and then I wrote The Rapture to prove that Hollywood would never do, you know, my best idea. And now I'm more deeply into Hollywood than I can say. Why did they make it? Is that the question? Or how did that happen?
Yeah, how did it happen? How did it happen that this... almost anti-Hollywood novel ended up being a Hollywood film?
Well, that it didn't happen with the major. David Brown, the producer, read the novel and called me, said he wanted to option it, and I was really hesitant about doing it, partly because I didn't want to tell the story again, and also because I was afraid that the book was so internal that it really couldn't be translated. And then, almost to my dismay, I found that a story really can transcend the form in which it's told, and the adaptation actually wasn't that hard to do. It didn't take me that long. Finally, my agent gave it to Robert Altman, who had just joined the agency, and at the same time, Tim Robbins had been given the script, and within about 3 weeks, we had a go picture with Avenue, which is an independent company.
The movie is directed by Robert Altman. He often, I think, changes scripts that he directs. Did he change your script a lot?
Not too much. One of the big decisions that affected the way the film came out is that he decided to use real movie stars in the background as extras. And once he committed himself to that, you know, you can't have a film which has a kind of a dead again foreground and then have Jack Lemmon playing piano and never saying a word in the background of a cocktail party scene. It has to become a comedy. And the film is actually quite funny.
Were you on the set playing the role of the protective wounded writer, or did you figure, well, whatever he wants to do with it, he's the director, I respect him, that's fine?
Let me see. The first week, the protective wounded writer. The second and third week, I backed off, and by the fourth week, there was a truce, and I let him just go ahead and direct, and I went back to work on something else.
What was responsible for your change of tone?
I don't know. Well, I think what was responsible was that I saw how things were going and I was able to relax. The first week for on any film is makes everybody nervous. Also, that he shot the murder of David Kahane over the first 4 days, and that was a special sequence. And then once he got into the body of the movie, I think everybody relaxed.
Now, talking to you, you really sound like such an industry outsider, but in a way, you're an industry insider by virtue of your family. Your father used to write for TV, and your mother was a senior vice president at Paramount, yes?
Right.
So you must have really grown up pretty close with movies and TV, and pretty close with
well,
a lot of industry
my father
people.
Worked steadily, so that was already gave me the wrong idea about Hollywood. And at the same time, he's a... I don't know. He was born in Russia, and my mother was first-generation Canadian. Her parents are from Romania. So I wasn't a typical American kid. I'm first-generation American, and I lived in a house which was more European than American, you know, books and music. And I can't actually say that I'm not all that Hollywood. I had three movies made this year, but all three of them were made, two of them were at New Line and one of them was at Avenue. My one studio experience was Gleaming the Cube 5 years ago, and that was hardly a great experience. I've been working in independent Hollywood for the last 3 years, which is very different from the majors.
But it must feel funny to you to have come from an industry family and then end up feeling like such the outsider.
Well, but the family itself is a sort of an outsider family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not, it's not a, you know, it's not, they didn't have seats at all the celebrity tennis tournaments when I was growing up. Last night I had a dream about the Bel Air Country Club that I wanted to join. I don't know what that means.
Oh, this means you're on the verge of selling out.
I don't know. It was an interesting dream. The country club was, I took a wrong turn in Bel Air and suddenly it looked like Vermont. And there were all these people at the Bel Air Country Club, Russian immigrants and Iranians and rich WASPs, and it seemed very idyllic.
It was country club.
What?
The multicultural country club.
The multicultural country club, right, with a really beautiful lake.
Michael Tolkien, his film The Rapture will be opening in many cities over the next few weeks. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Howard Berkus is reporting tonight from Killeen, Texas, on the day after the mass killings there at a restaurant. Elizabeth Arnold reports from Capitol Hill on gun control legislation now moving through Congress, especially as regarding assault weapons. Letters from listeners this evening about the Thomas confirmation, pro and con about the entire process, as you could imagine. Also about the controversy over the book The Education of Little Tree. And an America's Watch report about violence against women in Brazil. Much of it goes unreported and unpunished. And a farewell to Tennessee Ernie Ford, who died yesterday at age 72.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, CBS is broadcasting the World Series. To counter-program against that, the other two networks are reaching into their pasts. ABC begins a 4-hour miniseries version of Dynasty. NBC presents a telemovie with the self-explanatory title, I Still Dream of Jeannie. TV critic David Bianculli is here with some thoughts on these productions and the other big TV production of the past few days.
I was going to spend this entire time talking about those two shows, but I can't. In the first place, ABC didn't provide Dynasty for preview, so the only thing I've got to judge it by, other than its slick and silly reputation, is an on-air promo in which Joan Collins delivers this memorable performance.
Your days are numbered, bimbo.
Gee, I can't wait. But actually, I can. In fact, I wish more networks would withhold bad shows from review. It'd sure make my life a lot easier. Oh, please, Brer Network. And though I have seen I Still Dream of Jeannie, I wish I hadn't. Having Barbara Eden play this subservient Jeannie again, along with her scheming sister, is kind of creepy. Larry Hagman walked away from this show a long time ago, but Eden won't. And though she's aged well, the show's concept hasn't. The lack of a laugh track in this case only points out how few laughs there are, none to be precise. And the plot of this story, explained to Jeannie by a powerful djinn, is stupid even by I Dream of Jeannie standards.
I may stay?
You know better than that, my child. The scroll says you must have a master to remain in the plane of reality. I hereby grant you additional time so you may find a temporary master. You will be his genie until your real master returns.
What I like most about that is the suggestion that I Dream of Jeannie has a plane of reality. I don't have a genie, but if I did, I'd wish reunion shows like this would go back in their bottle. To me, what's worth talking about this week is the plane of reality, the fallout from the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. The hearings themselves were astounding, but the aftermath has been pretty amazing, too. People inside and outside the process are talking now about making reforms, seeking solutions, and mending fences. But a close look at TV the last few days suggests that may be impossible. On the day of the Senate vote, Orrin Hatch, the exorcist-waving Republican from Utah, said this about charges that the White House had helped manipulate events during the hearings.
The fact of the matter is, anybody believes that, I know a bridge up in Massachusetts that I'll be happy to sell to them with the help of Senator Kennedy.
Within the hour, Hatch hurried back to the microphone to say he was mortified by his mix-up and asked for, quote, unanimous consent that the word Massachusetts be deleted and the word Brooklyn be substituted therefore as originally intended, unquote. Yeah, right. And if anyone believes that, I know a little tabernacle in Utah. The point is, even though the congressional record now shows no record of that cheap shot, the electronic record does. Anyone who watched the speeches live or watched Nightline that night knows it happened. Television has become the new congressional record, and in the long run, that's a good thing. In the short run, TV is also good at showing just how raw and sensitive an issue this is. Last night on Nightline, Ted Koppel presided over a 2.5-hour town meeting devoted to examining the process and seeking possible solutions. Instead, it underlined the dissatisfaction of many people not only with the process, but with the politicians. Here's an exchange between management consultant Clifford Alexander, a black audience member, and Alan Simpson, a Republican senator from Wyoming.
Perhaps somebody ought to speak to you the way you talk to them. Wait a second. Let me tell you something for a change.
All right.
Let me tell you, had Anita Hill decided to file a complaint, she didn't have a job to get back, so she wouldn't have gotten
that
a job.
Is not
Let
true,
finish,
sir.
Senator.
That
Let
is not
finish,
true,
Senator.
Sir. That's in the record. It's
Let
not
me
being
finish,
true.
If you don't mind.
Yes, but you've had two shots, and I've been sitting listening quite courteously.
For every
this
shot,
is part of this.
Every
too.
Shot I'm getting,
well,
you've had 100, sir. And you'll have 100 more, because after this show, there are no black people in the Senate, so don't worry about us. We're through
well,
after this
Well, that brings
show.
Another that racist true, aspect so, to it. That,
yes, another racist aspect.
That's right.
As
That's what it does.
It.
That's
as
right.
As you described it.
That's
as
right.
As you described it, Senator.
That's right.
Now, if we can...
Koppel's program was wonderful in the sense that people talked about all sorts of important issues. It was sad, though, because anyone watching could see that while a lot of people were talking, almost no one was listening.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as plans continue for a Middle East peace conference, we take a closer look at Syria. We talk with Andrew Whitley of Middle East Watch, which has just published a report on human rights violations in Syria. Also, we ask 85-year-old comic Henny Youngman how old his jokes are. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.